I've shared a little bit about the suppression costs and resource loss and private property damage trends. Let me describe reality as I see wildfire risks on the national forests in the United States. Three major factors seem to be converging: drought, overaccumulated fuels, and growth patterns at the wildland-urban interface. Our fire seasons are hotter than they've been before. In many places, fire danger indices are commonly exceeded from year to year. Our fire seasons seem to be starting earlier. They seem to be lasting longer. They seem to be covering broader areas than they have in the past. The recently released United Nations report on climate change found that the past 7 years of data indicated the sixth warmest on record. Within the fire services, this finding is ringing true. In terms of fuels, the rate of fuel accumulation on national forests remains far greater than the rate of fuel treatment. In many areas, insect infestations and disease outbreaks, largely due to drought, are exacerbating the problem. Last month, wildland fire administrators, in testifying before Congress, noted that wildfire losses are occurring 3 times faster than they can treat the fuels that cause those fires. Much of the large fire problem in the United States seems to be most urgent and most troubling in the shorter interval fire-dependent ecosystems. They typically occupy the warmer, drier sites. In the western U.S., these sites are commonly at or near valley bottoms where people live and work. That brings me to the third trend. It's at this interface zone that over 8.5 million new homes were built in the 1990s. With few exceptions, most of these homes were built where people wanted and how people wanted, with few or any regulatory controls or with little regard for wildfire threats. Some suggest that perhaps we should just simply protect homes at the interface and let high-intensity wildfires reduce the fuels for us. The silver bullet, though, overlooks important ecological ramifications. They involve energy cycles, nutrient cycles, water cycles. The solution also ignores adverse impacts towards other values like soils, watersheds, endangered species habitat, biodiversity, and the overall health and resilience of the general forest. The problems that come with some of these solutions may be most acute in the shorter interval fire regimes where ecological function depends more on frequent low-intensity burning. It doesn't help that sometimes the distance between fire managers, resource specialists, and research has too often become too great. Our policymakers are not always aware of the unintended consequences that can accompany the expedient solution. We'd be wise before we jump to a silver bullet to staff out the second and third order effects of our decisions. In the American experience, these effects often prove more consequential than first expected. I'm reminded when I read the newspapers and read about a little town called Licola in Victoria, about a place called San Bernardino, California, where following the fires in 2003, a rainstorm one night killed 7 people and virtually wiped a little town out of a valley. I believe that megafires are more than fire managers can solve in isolation. They are emerging as more of a land management issue than the more commonly perceived fire failure. Let me give you an example. We're finding that resource objectives we could achieve in the 1970s and 1980s in fire-adapted ecosystems under more moderate environmental conditions are objectives that we can't always achieve today. In the U.S., for instance, endangered species habitat and watershed protection objectives often relied on minimizing disturbance, keeping fire out, and preserving late successional stand conditions. The objectives counted on fire suppression capacity to achieve that objective. But we're seeing today that these land management objectives simply no longer seem feasible. Hotter conditions and increased fuels. In fact, the dense multi-storied stand conditions and undisturbed biomass that were often the best habitat or the best filters may now be the factors that are fueling the most intense fires. Ironically, we may be inadvertently managing four high-consequence wildfires. In this new dynamic, the tragedy of large destructive wildfires isn't limited to the skyrocketing cost of fire suppression. The wildfires are often burning the very values that we're attempting to save. The loss of habitat, watersheds, and other critical resources are consequences that may be much more serious over the long term, particularly where they're proving to be irretrievable. And we haven't thought about that much. If we're going to solve the megafire problem in the U.S., we're going to need the help of resource specialists that can tailor sustainable land management objectives in ways that are consistent with the dynamics of these fire-dependent ecosystems. I'd stand on that. We're also going to need the help of lawmakers and policymakers. Let me follow with another example. The notion of thinning and prescribed burning and even harvest, those are good ones, I believe. They can always go too far. But fundamentally, those are sound practices. They have an important place in the management of fire-dependent ecosystems. But there seems an implicit bias in many of our land management laws that govern our prescribed fire and thinning and harvest activities. In the U.S., prescribed burning, for instance, must be compliant with requirements under the Clean Air Act. If it affects the human environment, it's going to be subject to compliance under the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. May also be compliant to the Endangered Species Act or any number of other laws because it's a management action that affects the human environment. But wildfires remain largely exempt from these requirements, even though their consequences are proving much, much more severe. When many of these laws were enacted, disturbance ecology was largely unknown and rarely applied. I don't want to argue against the intent of these laws, don't get me wrong. But I do want to point out that the results of these laws in a changed environment in terms of drought and overaccumulated fuels may actually be working against the resource, not for it. And especially so in fire-dependent ecosystems. When many of our land management laws were enacted, we often assumed that doing nothing or adopting a passive, hands-off land management strategy was the sure way to best protect the resource. When disturbance regimes stood still in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, probably didn't matter much. But today, when drought and overaccumulated fuels change the dynamic of disturbance, it's probably time to take another look at what these laws really achieve. Again, I'm not suggesting that we weaken these laws. I'm suggesting that these laws need to become more sophisticated, given the complexities and the dynamics that we're confronting today. Our wildland fire protection strategy is suppression-centric or response-centric for a reason. It's too damn hard, too damn cumbersome, too damn contentious, and too damned expensive to do otherwise. And we've got to confront that. And fire managers need the help of policymakers and lawmakers to do that. As I wrap up, let me suggest a new role for research. In the last several years, research has brought us a lot of new knowledge about fire behavior and fire ecology, decision support, firefighter safety. And more recently, under your bushfire CRC, the social sciences are beginning to emerge as an important research topic, and you should be commended for that. Perhaps now one of the most valuable roles that research might play has to do with some scenario planning, projecting trends. What are the suppression costs and property losses and resource damages expected with respect to trends and climate and fuels accumulation and development at the wildland-urban interface? What do those trends look like? And in that context, what are the expected risks to biodiversity, sensitive species, and maybe most urgently here, water? And would we change the mix between prevention and mitigation and response based on where those trends might be going? Should we simply extend today's laws and policies and practices in this changed environment, or is it time to step back and reevaluate the strategies and the direction that these programs are taking? Are the changes so great that we need to redefine our laws and practices and policies in the context of this new dynamic? Certainly, without the advantage of science-based, credible information, few of our publics will ever see the need to change behaviors, and few of our lawmakers will ever find the resolve to establish safeguards for the greater good over the longer term. I don't know that there's a country in the world right now that has yet confronted the new realities of these alarming trends in climate and fuels and growth at the interface. I don't know that there's a country in the world that has yet confronted those realities. In the U.S., we're wanting to, we're trying to, we make a little progress towards it, but we're not there by a long measure. Certainly here in Australia, I believe you are poised to be a world leader in this area. The challenge for fire managers today is to reevaluate the fire protection strategy that's going to govern our activities in the context of these trends. The danger of simply doing what we already do, but perhaps doing it bigger, building more capacity in terms of response or suppression, trying to do it harder, will have our public and political critics believe that the problem and its solutions are confined to the performance of the fire services. We've got to get outside of ourselves. When we're overwhelmed with the 1% wildfire in the U.S., nobody applauds the 99% of fires that went well. Most disaster and loss is directly attributable to some kind of fire operations failure. Fire managers are held accountable, and the common criticism is you should have seen it sooner, acted faster, tried harder. most overlooked that flawed expectations for the land actually predisposed this catastrophe, and fewer still acknowledge that homes built in a wrong place made them indefensible. Denial and anger and blame are among the emotions of confronting reality. The realities of climate change and fuel change and interface change are real, and they're a serious threat in my estimation. In this reality, we need to look forward. Looking back will only be a distraction, won't accomplish much. And it's not really that what we've always done is wrong. It's that circumstances have changed, and we had the wisdom to see it and act on it. In the fire services and the U.S. Forest Service, much of leadership is about situational awareness, seeing problems as they are, not as we wish they were, and acting on those problems. Are big fires inevitable? Can we deal with the differences that divide us? Can we do the analysis that will help distinguish perceptions from reality? Without that analysis, there is no basis for whatever fire protection strategy you adopt. Can we see these trends and act on them? Thank you.